This episode of The Big Interview was first broadcast on the 7th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Tom Edwards, and this is The Big Interview on Monocle 24, our one-on-one show where people with fascinating lives, enviable careers, and plenty of great tales sit down and tell us how they got to where they are today, what inspires them, and what makes them tick. Today's guest became internationally renowned as the creative force behind some of the world's most successful brands, creating corporate images and advertising campaigns for companies like Esprit, Chanel, Fiorucci, and United Colors of Benetton. Famed for his hard-hitting imagery of AIDS patients, anorexia, and members of the clergy locked in passionate embrace, to name but a few, his work is as politically powerful as it was commercially successful. Oliviero Toscani was born in Milan in 1942. His father was the photojournalist Fedele Toscani. After working at a number of magazines, Oliviero got his big break in 1982 when he started working as art director for the Benetton Group. Now residing in Toscana in Italy, he not only continues his work, but also makes time to breed stallions, press olive oil, and even produce some world-class wine. He sat down in conversation with Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé.
If we would rewind maybe 20, 25 years ago, when you used to have to come into the UK, you used to have to fill out these immigration forms, and there would always be a question, occupation. Now, if this was today and you had to write down your occupation, what do you say that you are today?
Well, you know, first of all, I must say that it was nice to travel around without passport lately, you know, and now suddenly here,
everything's changed.
Pisa, Italy to Paris, you have to take, I mean, it's terrible. We're going backward. So that really disturbed me. But occupation, well, I enjoy myself because I wouldn't do anything that I wouldn't like to do. So I'm a very, you know, we have to start from this point. I'm not embarrassed to say that I'm probably the luckiest and the most privileged man I ever met in my life. So it's true. No, even when the thing doesn't go right, ups and down, even in the down, I think it's a privilege. I've been lucky, lucky, very lucky. So occupation, I say, well, actually, I should be retired since 10 years. So, occupation, I'm not retired.
Okay, that's a good starting point. So, would we say at the top of the heap are creative director, broadcaster, photographer, all of those things, which is a lot to fill out on a form.
Breeder, horse breeder, winemaker, olive oil maker, I don't know. So, it's just one job, you know, just do one thing.
I was going to say, you know, winemaking alone, that would make you the luckiest man in the world.
Yeah, yeah. It is a fantastic project because, you know, I don't make the thing myself. I always got great people that are better than me. So I rely on them, on technical and how to do it. Mm. But at the end, everything has got the same kind of quality. That's my work, you know, to give that kind of look and quality to the thing. And I'm not even a creative director, because not even God was directing, you know, you did everything alone. So just give the way, the direction, you know, like that.
When you look at all of the things that you've done over the course of your career, has there been something unique, or has Italy offered you a certain set of opportunities that, you know, could you have done what you've done if you were German-based, or had you been in New York versus Hamburg versus London even? Because I'm fascinated. You know, in a contemporary sense, Italy gets such a hard time. But yet, Italy, no matter what, always seems to work. And you always see extraordinary innovation, despite the headwinds that are in the country. So do you think that Italy afforded you and continues to afford you an interesting platform?
Well, I didn't choose to be Italian, first of all. So I'm never really proud of what, you know, that I'm male, that I'm 187 centimeter, I didn't choose that. So I never take that as an advantage. But I'm a son of a photojournalist, and I left home to study when I was like 14. And then I studied at the Kunstgewerbeschule, the school of Hochschule für Gestaltung in Zurich, 5 years. And I came to London in 60, you know, for an exchange at Royal College. And here I was to see the Beatles concert in 62. And so I never really studied the language, but I can speak five. I don't know why. So that means that I'd been traveling, the girls and the friends were from all over the world. So that's how I learned. So that's why I say I've been lucky. And not, I don't think it's a question of being Italian or not, no. I know people who are just exactly like me, and they don't come from my country. You know, in every country there's this kind of people that I cross all the time, that have been crossing all the time. And of course, England has been very important to me because the first time I came to England, I was like 18, and I was on the beach of Brighton, you know, the mobs and the rockers. I was there. And first long hair and everything. I went through all that, and King's Road, and I met all those people. And then I came here a lot in the 70s. I did a lot of work for British Vogue. Mm-hmm. And every month I was spending a week in London in the 70s. And the same thing in New York. And I lived in New York for, well, when I finished school, 65, I started to work for a magazine. And then American Bazaar and Vogue, they called me in the United States, and I worked there. And I got my little student Carnegie Hall in the last floor, 1215. So it's a lot of traveling around since 50 years. I mean, constantly on the plane. And just to tell you how it is, I've got six children, okay? Out of three different women. None of my wives, call them wife, they were Italian. So I got three wives with three different passports, with six children with different passport. And then I got 12 grandchildren, and I'm the only one to have an Italian passport. I'm the only one to have an Italian passport. They all have the Italian passport plus their own country. So when they all get together, there is, they speak French, they speak English, speak German, speak Swedish, speak Norwegian, everything is going on. So I don't believe this division by country. Of course, being Italian, I played with in the piazzas, and probably the influence of having such an architecture around and having kind of education around that. But I come from a very liberal family, you know, so I got two older sisters and me, and also my older sister is a photographer like my father. So I also did a job like it all time, you know, like your father is a musician. Okay, I'm a musician. Mozart. So, I don't know, of course, Italy, but I live in Italy, not because I'm Italian. You know, I got a place in Paris, for example. I do work a lot in Paris. I got a place in Paris, like a home, like a studio. But my home is on my farm in Italy, yes. And there I'm at home. Otherwise, I'm traveling, and I really enjoy to be in Paris. I've got friends there, and everything's going on, and in New York and in London, and lucky.
I want to go, I guess, maybe back to a time or an era when, I guess, when your name came into, I would say, the real sort of public consciousness, and you know, those were obviously the Benetton years, certainly from an advertising point of view, the rise, of course, of what was developed with the magazine and many other things. Was that a unique circumstance to be able to work with a client like Benetton? I'm just curious about the relationship. Who was the provocateur? Was it a very sort of willing client in terms of the Benetton family saying, Mr. Toscani, go for it. We want to make a name. And how much of it was, let's make an international name versus let's provoke versus let's sell lots of sweaters?
No, it's not so complicated as everybody thinks, you know. First of all, everybody knows me, of course, of Benetton, but I think the reason is because Benetton is the one who invested the most on my work. Because 10 years before Benetton, I did a campaign called Jesus Jean. That was a big riot, you know. I gave the name of the jean, Jesus Jean, JJ, and who loved me has to follow me, and there was an incredible picture of a backside of a person. And so it was, and so, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright say the quality of the architecture depend on the intelligence of the committee. And actually, I produce something but I need to have a commitment. Lorenzo il Magnifico, you know, Michelangelo didn't have certain popes, he wouldn't have done the Sistine Chapel, okay? And now we remember Michelangelo, but we don't know which was the pope, because those they were just investor on power. And today we should have those kind of popes, but we don't. There aren't so many. And that's why there is a crisis, I think. You know, everybody thinks just of the economical result. Mm. And of course, when you are, let's say, an artist and you work for somebody to look for an image, to produce an image, and the image can be done through a magazine, through a picture, through a movie, through anything, design, architecture, right? I work on that field. The first thing you have to do to get the real freedom of expression, and that is the only thing that could be interesting because everybody is producing something different if he's a real artist, you know, if you don't copy or... The first thing you have to do is to enrich your commitment. Enriching somebody doesn't mean just economically, but, culturally, powerful, and politically, ethically. And so the first thing you have to do is that. So you get your trust on you. And then when you get they trust you, because it works, then you can start to do interesting things. And that's what's happening always with my commitment. I work with few people. I never work. For example, I don't work with advertising agency. I hate to work for advertising. It doesn't work. They are not in love with what they do. Mm. They just go after the budget. They do focus group and marketing research. All that is wrong, totally wrong. It's just, since there is this word marketing, we got into a disaster artistic method. So I can't work with advertising agency. So I work directly with a certain kind of commitment or industrial, produce certain thing. I don't care what they produce. But normally these kind of people also produce always interesting stuff. And as a son of a photojournalist, and that's how I started to be a photographer, I realized that as a photojournalist, I could make something interesting for a magazine, for example, but just for the people who read that magazine. And normally people who read the magazine, they think like the magazine. Personally, normally, I always buy the newspaper, the magazine, that is opposite of what I think, on top of the one I like, because I like to see what is the opposite. But working as a reporter or photo reporter for a magazine, it would have been very limited. So I say, how can I propose the work on a worldwide system through advertising. And advertising is another way to communicate. The Sistine Chapel, it was an advertising of the church, very commercial. At that time, there wasn't any picture, any movie, any television. The only way where you could see images was walking to a church and see how God and Virgin Mary and the angel look like. All fake also, no? Could be also all fake, but that's how it went. So there is such a thing as advertising and reportage. Everything is a reportage for me. So I said, I'm going to apply that to a worldwide campaign at Benetton. And I told Luciano, listen, let's do the best. It's something that never been done before. And he said, okay, let's go ahead. And I said, listen, I just work, you and me, you say me yes or not, okay?
No one in between.
Nobody. Just no agency, no marketing people now, please. And he said, okay. And he understood that. And anything I did was interesting in my life. That's how it was made. You know, the campaign about anorexia, that wasn't Benetton, was another client like that. Jesus Gene and the book about Santani Stazema. I got a lot, sometimes also very little work and nobody see, just very local. Mm. But that's my way to proceed. And, you know, of course, you get all kind of criticism from the intellectual of photography, you know, that they call the reportage, the Cartier-Bresson. But did Cartier-Bresson ever raise the problem of racism? Did they ever talk about real human problem of difference and wars? No. Just aesthetics. Okay? I don't care when it's just aesthetics. Anything in art is just aesthetics, like, you know, composition, putting the color together, the state is mediocre. In art, there is just only one task, and this is the human condition. I look at a big piece of art, you know, the scream of Munch and thing, and Pietà di Michelangelo, everything is human condition. Mm. But it can be also abstract, but you feel inside that there is a struggle in Pollock to feel the human condition. Eh? Mm. So that's what I tried to do. And that was my point of view, my way of working, you know. And it's still today. As soon as I can, I do that. It's not possible to do it every time, but I don't do really commercial work, real commercial work. I don't do it. I can survive without doing that. Mm. I'm not against people who just take pictures just because of pictures, but you can take a still life and have something of human condition inside. Doesn't mean that has to be a tragedy or something deep. It's just that feeling of the touch. And that's what I'm trying to do still.
You mentioned crisis. You brought up the word crisis. How broad are you applying that term? Are you talking about a crisis in media, in communications? Are we referring to the crisis that confronts Italy at the moment, that confronts Europe? What were you referring to when you talk of crisis?
Well, normally people call crisis when there is an economical crisis. But I think a crisis is somewhere else. So it's much more important than the economy, I think. There are countries that have got less economical crisis, but I think they got much deeper crisis as a human system. I wouldn't live in certain country that probably economically they are rich, but they don't have freedom, they don't think. They have to hide themselves, they have to... No.
So a few countries come to mind.
well, there are a lot still. You know, the world is not civilized yet. Huh? We are on the way, but it will take a long time still, I think. And when I think what's going on right now in the world, I mean, sometimes I'm embarrassed to think that I belong to the human race. I'm embarrassed. You know, discrimination, you know, look at what's going on, the discussion about coppia civile in Italia, you know, the marriage, that's the discussion as a stupid thing. I mean, those things, they are all one battles, and we are waiting that they're going finally to be, they will say, okay, that's how it is. We are waiting for that, like that penalty. You know, today, more or less, we laugh about slavery, okay? But just think what they went through to make slavery outlaw. I mean, that wasn't so long ago. And so I think we are on the road to a better civilization, but we have to go through a lot of things. You know, when I was born, for example, I was born in a fascist, Nazi, royalistic country, Italy, 1942. I was saved in 1942, this is a funny story. My mother actually wanted to abort because she already had two oldest daughters. She was already 34, and at that time, being 34, having a baby was late. But she couldn't. You know why? The British, the Royal Air Force, saved me. Because in 1942, they were bombing Milan like crazy. So the hospital didn't work. So I was saved by the British bombs. Just think. If in the shelter you call where you go, and I was like 7 months, 1 year old, I would say, listen, people, under the bomb, listen, in 70 years, we will have a unified Europe. We'll have just one money, more or less. Huh? We will travel just probably the ID. And they would say, "This, hey, lady, your son is sick. Get rid of him." No, I wasn't sick. So I can go on saying the same thing for the future. I think that what is happening, it will help us to get more civilized. A crisis is an incredible opportunity to understand. So that's how I take it. You know, you never thought. I mean, I remember the first time I went to the United States in the 60s. There was discrimination. White couldn't pee in the same place. No, the black couldn't pee in the same place as a black. And now we got a black president, okay? So that's how I think it goes. It's like a pendulum, you know? The time goes on, but the pendulum can be more behind than when the pendulum was behind and the pendulum in front. You know that? So I'm optimistic.
Going back to the notion of crisis, do you think we're in a media crisis right now? And let's take it out of an Italian context globally. When you see, you talk about reportage. In one way, you could say, yes, there's more people with their own cameras and people are doing their own stories. But then do we know if these are legitimate stories? You know, we see less and less investment in big journalism. Some would say, yes, there's foundations who fund it, etc. Others would argue that, no, we see a complete erosion of proper journalism. You look at the rolling news channels. They all try to behave in the same way. They're all chasing the
marketing.
Same story.
marketing. Marketing is ruining. Everybody tries to be the same. Everybody trying to do what they think is the best thing to do for the market. There is a lack of courage. And I really don't understand how people can be all the same. You know, the other day I was taking gas in my car, and here stopped a truck with a 9 or 12 different car, you know, the one who transport car. And they look all the same, and I say, but they're not all the same. They're different brands.
But they're all the same.
They're all the same. What's happening here? We are afraid of difference. And we all conform, we all copy. We are happy with that. And so I think that anybody who does that at the end is really frustrated. The lack of courage to go for something you believe, really. And no, you conform to what they tell you that's the right thing to do. And there is such a thing as the right thing to do. You know, anytime we are not secure, we stop. This is the wrongest thing you can do. You can't be creative and be secure. It's impossible. If you are secure, that means you are doing something you've already done. That you know the result. So you shouldn't be afraid to be afraid. Got nothing to lose. What have you got to lose? They won't even let you starve anymore if you live in a civilized country. Try to starve, go in the street and say, I'm starving. They won't let you. No, that's how it is. You have to put safety belt. It's crazy. So
but isn't,
we are scarce. We're scarce.
I don't think this is interesting because suddenly we have a lack of adventure. Because you said we have to wear a helmet all the time. We have to be belted in. And I think this is, it's an erosion of common sense. I mean, suddenly if I know that everything has been looked after for me, I don't have to think anymore.
The politically correct is a big ruin. Big ruin. Before you say, well, what is to provoke and the letter. You know, I always ask myself, the word provocation got a negative meaning. Why? To provoke is what, I go to the movie, I want to be provoked. I read a magazine, I want to be provoked. I listen to a radio, I want to be provoked. You know, but you watch TV, you never provoke, for example, because it's, everything is planned. Probably TV did make a lot of ruin, especially in Italy. I mean, it's really castrated the country.
The never-ending variety show on Rai.
Yeah, and then you know, terrible. It's been a dictatorship, you know, ugly, and on top ugly, terrible. Ah, drive me crazy.
It is quite I always think there is this incredible disconnect in Italy because you can have beautiful cinema, you've got beautiful magazines, you know, a lot of fantastic print comes out of Italy, but then you turn on the television, it has nothing to do with the rest of the media.
Nothing. No, but Italy, you know, can be taken. When you say Italy, that is not like, say, England, let's say, Great Britain, like, say, France. Italy is not like that. What is? From the Dolomite or Sicily, first of all. So what is that? And then in Italy, we haven't got the sense of the state. So when French people, for example, they got a sense of the state. They are French. I don't go around saying I'm Italian. I don't care. My state really helped me. Italy is made by individual people. That's it. We are individual. Not individualist, but individual. We are alone. In a way, we are alone. Mm. Everyone is alone. And we look for each other. And we get together when we think we could make something. That's why it's difficult to get together, it's difficult to make societies, it's difficult to make anything in Italy because there isn't an organized system to get you together to the other one. So we are a country made by individuals. And the real interesting one, they've never been helped by the country. The country has been always an enemy. I didn't go to do the military service, of course, because I also belong to that generation. But I wouldn't serve my country. I would serve a country in case. So this is my mentality. And there is a lot of this mentality in Italy. And, of course, it's nice to say Italy. We sound good, you know, and the best food, for sure, and the best light, and the best. You know, that's why I live there. And I don't live there because I'm Italian, of course. I say always to my wife, you know, you live here because the country is incredible. And also the mess is incredible. The mess is incredible. It drives you crazy. Sometimes you say, how can I go on living like that? But at the end, I say, it's fantastic. I don't know if it's a question of being primitive or very much civilized.
Yeah, and sometimes the two merge. Oh. It becomes very blurred.
Sometimes you better go away, you know. The last, you know, when they get really difficult, I just go away a week, and then I come back and I forgot about that. In Italy, we got succhi gastrici, gastric sauce, as they call it. The one you got in your stomach to digest.
Gastric juices.
Yeah, specially made, yeah. We digest anything. You know, we digest Berlusconi. I mean, it's forgotten now. It's gone. Incredible. Drive in, ruin Italy in this program, and now it's gone. It's ridiculous. Nobody voted for Berlusconi. You ask in Italy, you go down to some school convention, and from, you know, 1,000 people, whoever voted Berlusconi? Nobody voted in Berlusconi. No. That is great. It's gone.
Just before we go, and I do want to end on an Italian note, just before we went into this discussion, we were talking about, the migrant crisis. Amazing that, you know, we're also looking at a Europe where there are walls and borders going up again, and you need your ID card and all of these things. You talk about the pendulum swinging, and we've gone back to a place that even 7 or 8 years ago, we wouldn't have thought we would have seen a Europe like this. Does it endure for a while, do you think?
Well, I hope not. I hope not, because, you know, I am for opening totally the door. Big country has been made by big migration. America didn't even think to be so lucky. They didn't know. They didn't even want at the beginning to have the, you know, the wasps. They didn't want the other people, but they've been lucky. That happened. Everybody went to America, and everybody in America say, I'm American. And you see a yellow guy say, I'm American, black guy say, I'm American, the polka dot is American, and everybody's American, huh? This is incredible luck. And every country who did face this problem is more interesting than the other one who didn't have that problem. So the future is like that. We have to open, because of course a lot of idiot people will come in, but a lot of new intelligence, energy, new blood, new reasons will come in too. And we need that, because Europe started to be tired, I think. Starting to be tired. And when you start to be afraid, that means you start to be tired. When you start to close the custom, that means you are afraid. Mm. And when you are afraid, normally you make mistakes. And I hate to go and visit my daughter, and I need a passport. And I hate that my grandchildren have to come to see me, they need a passport. I can't stand that.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with Tyler Brulé in conversation with Oliviero Toscani. The Big Interview is produced and edited by Bill Luthi and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to this and any of our other programmes on Monocle 24. They can be found on iTunes, SoundCloud, or of course at monocle.com. Until next time, all that's left to say is goodbye, and thanks very much for listening.